This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Hello everyone, this is Lana and you're listening to Radio 314, or as some say, the other Red Ice show. I've been doing this program for over 3 years now. And if you look through the archives, you'll partially see the path I've traveled to get to where I am today. From metaphysics and philosophy, to conspiracy, to anarchism, to the war on whites, with all that encompasses, we've all traveled a different path to get to where we are today. And that's why we have to remember to be patient and persistent with those around us and to show them the truth. Not one listener in the past wrote me to wake me up about white genocide. Not one. I found out later that people were frustrated that we weren't going there, but not one of those people tried to reach out to us, gently persuading us. Not one. That happened on my own. I wish someone sent me the memes and the proof years ago, but no one did. That's not good. You can't be frustrated with people for not seeing something and not try to help them see. So my point is, do everything you can for your family and friends to help get them to see what we're talking about. On another note, did you see my tweet that made several online publications surrounding the Ann Coulter debacle? It said, "It's time to tell friends and family about Jewish supremacy." Oh wow, did I get lots of love and open-mindedness after that one. You see, when it comes to the J tribe, any criticism of any sort is considered hate. So forget about pointing out how they are disproportionately represented in media, banking, entertainment, government, and so on, because they are in those positions simply from talent. You see, they can organize and hyperdrive for ethnic interests 24/7 because of the supposed Holocaust. But every possible attack on European Goyim is welcome and even encouraged. It's approved by the occupied establishment. Jews can be overrepresented without a second thought. America can even be concerned with Israel's borders more than America. But when whites are the majority in the country they built, and when they want a white country, it's white supremacy, of course. Such white supremacy that whites cannot even have a white country, let alone a white student union. We're told we can't even have white neighborhoods anymore. If you talk about Jewish supremacy, kiss your political, professional, and social life goodbye. That's how much power they have through the media. So of course we should be hammering this hypocrisy. They stand on lies and it will eventually crumble because each one of us who pricks that weak spot will help make it crumble. My guest today is no stranger to the topics we discuss. However, she comes from a very different background. I was encouraged to learn her story because European folks of all persuasions are waking up to folk consciousness, cultural Marxism, and the war on our people. She comes from the Glastonbury scene in the UK. Longtime listeners know Red Ice used to do plenty of shows on that scene. But as we woke up a bit deeper, we saw how left and how anti-white that scene really is. Sadly, many baby boomers have been in that scene for 30 plus years without pushing new boundaries. They're dried up, the energy is no longer there. Why? Because they still don't look at the megaliths in their own backyard from a pro-European, folk-honoring perspective. It was aliens or slaves or brown people or anyone but whites that built the European and even international megaliths, right? Wrong. Claire Randall has an honors degree in philosophy and psychology from Leeds University, a post-grad diploma in art therapy, and worked in psychiatry, mental health, personal development, and taught psychology and further education. She is the author of the book Waking the Monkey, Becoming the 100th Monkey. We'll talk about the 100th monkey and contorted New Age ideas that are now part of mainstream political thought. This and much more with Claire Randall coming up. Welcome, Claire. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Lana. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much indeed for having me on your show.
Well, this should be a lot of fun because you and I, we've already communicated quite a bit, and you're also a longtime Red Ice listener, and you have a very interesting journey to share, which I think can be helpful to others who have come from a similar path. So tell us about your eclectic background, which led to your book, Waking the Monkey.
I've had a lifelong interest in what you might call the esoteric. I bought my first book on the psychic sciences when I was about 14 or 15. It was just the kind of usual, you know, pulp that you would get back in those days. But when I was at university, I started doing meditation and pursued what you might call kind of a mystical edge of psychology, the philosophical end of philosophy of mind, comparative religion, and those kind of things. And I've also then qualified as an art therapist, and I've worked in mental health and taught psychology as well. But perhaps I should say, having gone over that, this then led me in the mid-90s to become involved with this event. It's kind of archetype of the New Age, I suppose you could say. And I don't want your listeners to be turning off the moment they hear the word New Age mentioned, because I think I've ended up with rather a new take on it, or rather a different take from the collective view, shall we say. So there was this, the event, the 100th Monkey event, which was, as the organizer called it, an experiment in consciousness, working with the idea of morphic fields in the way that Sheldrake has suggested it, to try and work with morphic fields that would help resolve conflict in the world, which at the time seemed a pretty good idea for me. I was exploring absent healing, areas related to remote viewing and spiritual healing, and so forth, in the early 90s, leading up to this event in 1995. And I had some quite, shall we say, catalytic experiences while I was at the camp, which eventually led me to consider that I should write a book about it. In fact, there were three camps altogether, but this book is just about the first.
Where did this term 100th Monkey come from?
There was a chap by the name of Ken Keyes, not to be confused with Ken Kesey, who also comes into the story, but there was an animal behaviourist called Ken Keyes, who in about 1960 did some experiments with, just observational experiments on monkeys on the islands off the coast of Japan, where there are still troops of monkeys that live in the wild. And the story goes that he noticed that a young monkey started cleaning the sweet potatoes that the experimenters were leaving out for the monkeys in the salt water, and thereby making them clean and better to eat without bits of grit and mud on them. So then they noticed that this behaviour was then adopted by most, but not all, of the monkeys in the tribe. They noticed that, you know, how the ones that were closest to the monkey were the first ones to pick it up, and then some of the older ones were the ones who never picked it up, and there was this kind of spectrum in between. But the most interesting thing was that a short while later, this behaviour was observed amongst the population of the next island. So this is where the concept, obviously we don't know how many monkeys it actually took, but the idea is that it's like an archetype or a seed crystal has been formed in the collective unconscious mind of, in this case, that monkey species. A monkey on the other island that was ready, I think this is an important point, a monkey that was ready somehow picked up or was inspired to do the same thing. And so then they did this. And this is how one of the ways that ideas are spread. It's a famous story that Leibniz and Newton both invented forms of the calculus at almost exactly the same time. And so it's an idea that the Sheldrakean morphic fields can be established and then transmitted through the collective mind.
Yeah, it's happening, whether people realize it or not. Monkey see, monkey do. Consciousness is still such a mystery. And when we say collective consciousness, I like to think of Jung, but many people think, New Age, hocus pocus. But the collective consciousness is what shapes our politics, culture, and everything, really. So how do you think the New Age movement has run with this, though?
Well, yes, this is probably the point where I have to kind of go back and review my process of writing this, because when I started this, 2001, it's many years ago, and it took me a very long time to write this book. It's fairly long at 470 pages, but it's not Proust, you know. I know a lot more about many of the things behind the history of this now than I did when I first started writing. I realised that there were two kind of embeddings going on here. One was the cultural embedding of the context of the camp, the 100th Monkey Camp. And second was the fact that there were certain cultural concepts embedded in my own mindset when I'd been writing. And I had to separate these out because basically I realized that obviously over the last couple of years, being a regular Red Eyes listener, I've been fully educated on the subject of cultural Marxism. And coming back to my book after having had this education, I realized that
it's very difficult.
I'd been writing all those years back in the noughties. I'd been writing under a kind of veil of cultural, a miasma of cultural Marxism that was a kind of tinted lens that I was looking through. So I was really, really glad that I had actually put it aside and gained all this extra information. So over the winter, when I did the final revision and edit, I had to be quite subtle about this because it would have been dishonest to have removed, to have tried to remove the culturally Marxist context of the events that took place in the book. That was 1995. I was aware of political correctness, but I know more than in the most introductory and superficial way that most of us were 20 years ago. You know, it almost seemed like a good idea at the time. And I couldn't eradicate that from the book, but I could lightly skim out my own projections into it that I had put in while writing.
Yeah, that's a challenge. That's a big one, trying to discuss concepts of the New Age movement while pointing out cultural Marxism, especially because New Ageism is very left.
Well, what I realized looking back, actually, this is very much an outgrowth of, well, I mean, you can take it all the way back to Blavatsky in the 1890s and Crowley and stuff like that. But then we have the more modern, obviously, Huxley's is a bit ambiguous about this because he's kind of giving it away. Then also you've got some of the early influences, like I'm thinking about Wasson and Bateson, the West Coast counterculture, astrology, new forms of psychology, and this all kind of coalesced in the 70s into what I've just been reading, this fascinating book. It's like a dead giveaway for all this. There's this book, I've had it lying around for years, but I've only recently read it, and I don't think I should have read it before, because you kind of need to have an understanding of the whole cultural Marxist re-education that's been going on to be able to understand this book, The Aquarian Conspiracy by Marilyn Ferguson, which was published in 1981. And it's a fascinating book because the thing is, I mean, I do believe that there are scientific advances and conceptual and consciousness advantages that have taken place over the last lifetime or so, which really have created the possibility of opening what you might call a new age. We are in a new age. We're in a technological age, which has never been known before. There's all sorts of new ideas coming along in science, like Sheldrake's morphic fields. And then there's people like there's that chap who's working on DMT, is it Rick Strassman, I think. And yet, it's only recently that I've started putting a kind of what you might call culture of critique onto this. And I've realised that so much of it is, it's very left-oriented. I'd never kind of realised this before, because I myself was embedded in a cultural leftist, cultural Marxist milieu, worldview, network, community that didn't challenge these things. I mean, this is, I think this is the problem that so many people have with breaking out of their conditioning, is that they don't even realize that it's conditioning.
Yeah, they don't even see how a lot of these new age concepts have become politically correct conformity, basically.
Yeah. I can actually look back to the first 100th Monkey Camp, the one about which I've written the book, and in it I have my own kind of rite of passage, my own journey of awakening, whatever you call it, by facing challenges which were both within myself but which were triggered by external events impinging on me, pressing my buttons and forcing me to go through, to deal with my own sense of empowerment, disempowerment, my own sense of victimhood. It wasn't really intended as any kind of critique of what you might call the New Age movement or such like. But nonetheless, it's impossible to avoid the fact that in the book, there is this counterpoint between individuality and collectivism. One thing I keep hearing people say on the internet, or I remember hearing Max Egan say this a couple of years ago, they're all saying, oh, what we really need is a bit of critical mass. Where's that 100th monkey? Where's that 100th monkey got to? Is it time for it to turn up? So this is my pitch for it. If the world's looking for the 100th monkey, well, I'm going to pitch this concept here for it, because I think that where the New Age has kind of been diverted is the idea that we can spread memes, collective ideas, politically correct ways of behavior. These are certainly getting the 100th monkey treatment, aren't they? It's mass belief systems and...
Yeah, 100th monkey doesn't always mean that it's a good thing that's catching
exactly,
on.
Exactly, Lana. And I found what sociologists call my own sense of agency. Now, what that means is that you realize that you have the power to change things. It might be only very small at first until you get more of a hang of it. But this, I believe, is the real thing that we should be focusing on for the 100th monkey. Because if we're really looking for, you know, all these things that all these people have talked about, a revolution in consciousness and, you know, the 2012 date and all that, it's been diverted into nothing more than establishing social memes. It's basically been dead-ended. Well, like so many things, how the music industry has been subverted and controlled. I think this is a very similar thing, because really, what are we looking at? If you're really looking at, you know, what is this changing the world thing? You know, what is this enlightenment thing? I mean, they are really just words that anybody can use to be whatever they want them to. You know, there's too much of this enlightenment is all just about a kind of wishy-washy kind of roll over and lie down, because, you know, I don't have the right to do anything to anybody else or even to claim my own identity. So, you know, I have to be, you know, loving and passive to everything, which of course, well, you know, kind of, I think we know where that leads to.
Yeah. I mean, if we look at the left today, they've really embraced a lot of these new age concepts. They're so optimistic. Excellent. They're in balance. Yeah. They're, you know, peace and love for everyone, just overly positive, haven't they?
And, in fact, the final chapter in Marilyn Ferguson's book, The Aquarian Conspiracy, is called The Whole Earth Conspiracy. There's all, you know, each chapter is some this conspiracy, that conspiracy. And the Whole Earth Conspiracy is this idea, kind of where we're at now, that, I mean, she actually says at one point, there are no such thing as natural borders. Well, you know, I don't know about her, but perhaps she's never seen a coastline. I grew up next to a coastline, and that is a pretty solid natural border. Mountains, rivers, seas, impassable forests, deserts, chasms. You know, there are plenty of natural borders. And what the problem I see with the Aquarian conspiracy is that it is blind to threats, hostility, psychopaths. You know, there was an excellent series that Henrik did a couple of years ago, I think, on psychopaths, and that was a real big part of my own kind of more recent drawing back of the curtains, because the New Age is too blind to this. It's all getting back down into, it's just collective memes that people have to conform to. We have two completely different levels of evolutionary movement here. The first one is not evolution at all. It's a dead ending into fixed thought structures, a behaviorist belief system. The other one is to get past this and get into the sense of agency. This is why, in a sense, I want to have this radical look at the New Age, because if the 100th monkey is only about conforming to collective belief systems, then I think that the creative spirit of the universe is a bit lacking.
Yeah, the state of our collective consciousness right now is very, very unhealthy. You know, as you're talking too, I'm thinking about a lot of these kind of New Age ideas springing out of the 60s counterculture, but then also around the same time was the 1965 Immigration Act, which drastically started changing the demographics of America. So I wonder if those two things kind of coincided, and if from the start the intentions were globalism. You know what I mean?
I mean, I'm aware of the 1965 Immigration Act. I mean, it's not something I've particularly, you know, focused on in my own stream. Although there's another counterculture thing that was going on at the time, which I think was a psyop, but I think that it didn't always. The thing is, these psyops don't always have quite the outcomes that the perpetrators want them to have. I mean, I mentioned earlier about Wasson and Bates and Bateman, Gregory Bateman, yes. And I've got a particular interest in this. I mentioned Ken Kesey earlier. Your listeners will know Ken Kesey is the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Because I think there was something going on here which I'd like to throw in a different angle to what some of Henrik's guests a while back have suggested about this. There certainly is the case, and I certainly wouldn't wish to contradict any of the research that's been done into the, I think it's the MK Ultra that Gregory Bateson carried out at the Palo Alto Veterans Hospital in the early 60s, about 60, 61, 62-ish. This was the way that they let the LSD kind of be leaked out into the community. It was quite clearly a psyop, employing somebody like Ken Kesey as the janitor. It's kind of asking for trouble, if you don't mind me saying. But the thing is, I think what they were trying to do in the Palo Alto experiments in the San Francisco Bay Area was a kind of wild culture. We're familiar with the very controlled culture of Laurel Canyon. There's a lot of work being done on those. All, you know, it made a lot of sense when Jim Morrison's father, being the admiral who was responsible for the Tonkin incident and stuff like that. The LA Laurel Canyon model, the birds, all that, was very much the popular alternative culture model. Whereas the San Francisco culture was this kind of wild culture that they let it have much wider parameters. Do you know what I mean? So I think the thing here is that I would like to throw in a different point of view to what some people say about this, because obviously it's well known, Kesey, his bus ride and all the LSD that Kesey and Owsley and then the Grateful Dead were involved in and stuff. It's very easy to look back on this and paint a particular view of it. But first of all, we have to remember that the federal law against LSD was not actually enacted until October 1968. Even in California, where all the stuff was really happening, it wasn't until late 66 when it was made illegal. So they were kind of the what was happening in the early 60s. I think to suggest that, for instance, one of the most well-known people who were subject to the MKUltra LSD experience was Robert Hunter. Now, Robert Hunter, who was the who became the songwriter for the Grateful Dead, he was only 19 when he first participated in the MKUltra experiments. So, my feeling is very much that to suggest that Robert Hunter is some kind of mastermind of the cultural Marxist world is you know, it's a kind of hindsight thing which doesn't really kind of match up with the actual evidence. I mean, the thing about Kesey and Hunter is they were both writers. Hunter, many people consider to be the greatest poet of the late 20th century in America. I mean, some of his words, he's a transcendental metaphysical poet, really. And so for him, you know, giving him LSD, it was like putting a child in a sweet shop. Now, we have people like Kesey and Hunter and then later the Grateful Dead. These are people with very, you might call it robust, adventurous mindsets. This stuff is not illegal. The government are kind of putting it out to the public almost like sweets, you know. But I think the very interesting thing is that while it certainly did create the kind of chaos and mayhem of the Haight-Ashbury scene, and then that all went downhill and you ended up with Altamont, 1969, you know, that person murdered in the Rolling Stones gig and the Grateful Dead pulling out of the show and everything like that. That was a major turning point in the counterculture in America. And that was the point at which the Grateful Dead very much turned away from that political thing and they concentrated on their community. And I think this is why they were able to survive. And in fact, when they recently had their 50th anniversary reunion show, President Obama actually sent them a congratulatory message, which I found quite amusing because it's kind of like they have been kind of in a way kind of outcasts for a long time because they certainly pushed envelopes and boundaries a lot. But the thing is, they were also they had a very robust survival attitude. They didn't really fit the cultural Marxist model after they'd moved away from the 60s. Chaos. I mean, they worked very hard. They became a national legend. They became very successful. It's very interesting when you get things like what I would call the wild culture that MKUltra created in San Francisco. I think you get kind of what you might call mutant survivors. While I certainly don't think that it's very responsible for people like Bateson to be going around doing these kind of experiments, obviously, because they are literally, they're social experiments and you have no idea what you're going to create. But I think also, to some extent, it also bounces back on them. Because, because there's something about the people who follow the Grateful Dead. There's something at the core of it, which is about community and self-reliance. And these are things which just somehow don't quite somehow fit into the cultural Marxist model. So I suppose that's the main thing I want to say about this, is that these cultures, whether it be the counterculture that was, you know, created back there in the 60s or the New Age culture, they don't always produce exactly what they're designed to, I think, is kind of where I'm going with this.
What do you think they were designed to? MK Ultra in the 60s? Are they basically trying to bring about some kind of degeneracy, or what were they trying to do?
I think they were trying to create a breakdown in society and create dependency and easily control population. There's always people who just won't fit in, however much they're squashed. It's really important just to encourage people to say, you know, that you can find your own way and you can find that sense of empowerment and not be the passive victim.
I noticed too, today it seems the West, we have this strange blend of like a hyper individualism mixed with this tyrannical collectivism, if you know what I mean. Mm. It's like a healthy collectivism is lacking, and then we've embraced this really unhealthy individuality. What do you think?
Well, I think you're right, Lana. And I think that it's, as with all the cultural Marxist things, everything is turned upside down and back to front and inside out. Everything is reversed. So we want a healthy, empowered individualism that embraces agency. So what do we get? We get a kind of degenerate individuality, which is all about, you know, pink iPhones and micro differences pop culture, basically. And what we want from the collective side is we want cooperation amongst groups with shared identity and interests, cooperating for their own benefit, not to the detriment of others. But what we get is collectivism where the individuality is suppressed, but the collectivism is actually directed against identity groups, because you have to eradicate the differences between identity groups so that they all kind of disappear. Although at the same time, I mean, it's all very contradictory, because of course only the minority identity groups somehow manage to.
Well, that's right. you could be anything you want to be unless you're white.
Well, indeed. And it's all about really just constraining people's thoughts, people's identities, bland washing, if you know what I mean. Bland washing everything. So that the New Age has been a perfect vehicle for this. Amongst those who are looking for some kind of spiritual pathway, but you know, conventional religions and so forth, you know, don't cut it anymore.
Well, and let's face it, it's mostly Western white people that are into these ideas. I mean, other places are still into more of their native spirituality.
Well, this is true, actually. I mean, I'm kind of rather concerned to find that how keen some of the leading speakers in New Age thought are actually to dissolve borders or allow infinite migration. Because when we were doing the camps in the 90s, virtually none of this was kind of on my horizon at all. But I did towards the end of the camp. Now, this is quite a difficult thing to talk about, this particular aspect here. But I do think that whatever we might say about the diversion and dead ending of the New Age, I do think there is something in it. And I think doing events like the 100th Monkey Camp are great. And we did some fantastic meditations, and I met some wonderful people, and we had some extraordinary experiences. Unfortunately, the main chap who organized the 100th Monkey Camp, a chap by the name of Paldon Jenkins, he's a kind of rogue genius in a way. He's a phenomenally gifted astrologer, and he does kind of psychic things, and he's written lots about crop circles and stuff, but he's also engaged with helping Palestinians. And so in this field, we have somebody like this who's tremendously gifted and quite influential in this kind of New Age, kind of Glastonbury kind of oriented kind of field. But I was very disappointed to find when I actually saw him speak at the Glastonbury Symposium this year. My view is that he's far too collectivist about this. And I think this is a great failing in the whole Aquarian kind of New Age movement. It's collectivism and looking down on your own people is missing the whole point. There was a superb interview in the archives on Red Ice. I would recommend subscribers to go back and listen to it. And if you're not a subscriber, then sign up. Because there's one, Stephen Ruback, in I think it's December 2007, was talking about the upside and the downside of the Aquarian Age, or rather the transition from Piscean forms into Aquarian forms. Now, Whereas Marilyn Ferguson, the author of The Aquarian Conspiracy, characterizes the Aquarian Age as all love and light, and I think we're familiar with that model, but look where it's taking us. Whereas Stephen Rubach, back in 2007, was saying, well, we have the Piscean Age, Lord Master, Victim Oppressor, Savior and Victim. That kind of mentality, isn't it? Compared to the Aquarian Age, where it's like, okay, there's a problem here. I'm not going to wait for a savior. I'm going to fix it myself. So this is the Aquarian Age fits in with the responsibility, empowerment, agency model, which is a true evolutionary step forward. Whereas what the EU presently is doing with regard to these hundreds of thousands of people coming across from Africa is that we are, well, I don't like to say we, that people like Merkel are playing out this kind of, well, she's kind of playing out a victim and a savior at the same time. You know, well, we have to be the savior for these people, but, you know, we're willing to make ourselves a victim and not to deal with these issues in a responsible way. One of the things that I find very, very unfortunate about a lot of New Age thought is that they think that with their memes of transformation, it's all about transformation, that they can leave behind basic scientific principles. I'm thinking, for instance, of systems theory. Now, systems theory, I was very fortunate when I was an undergraduate to actually see a guest lecture by George Miller, who was one of the kind of gargantuan, statuesque figures of psychology, who set up this theory and that is kind of one of the underlying foundation to properly understanding the way psychology works, because and life and biology, it's about systems have to be, systems have to have boundaries, they have to have inputs, they have to have outputs, they have to have, and this is, you can look at a cell, you can see, you know, a cell has a guiding principle, it has controlling structures inside there, it absorbs energy, it expels energy, and it has a defined cell wall. And every functional system has to have a defined boundary where it can have, you know, ionic exchanges or people going across borders or whatever. Now, any system, any group, any cell, any collection of cells that ceases to control the ionic transfer of molecules through its cell walls will cease to exist. You allow an amoeba to have too much salt, then it just pops, ex amoeba, you know. And under the pretext of no boundaries, all this, the New Age is the people who have really kind of almost unbeknownst to them kind of been infected with this, because it seems like in a way that the whole of Western civilization in a way is infected with this, or at least it's not kind of getting to grips with it. It's like it's, you know, hypnotized by a cobra or something.
I wanted to know too how, you know, you've been exposed to these concepts of the new right or primordial right. So how has it changed your spirituality and your view on things like astrology, meditation, your connection to nature? How has that evolved for you?
Well, I've had a very interesting journey with that over recent times, Lana. I've always, you know, had a kind of spiritual inclination. And
me too. Yeah. And it's definitely changed as I'm curious how it's changed for
you. One of the things that's evolved in the last few years is that it was in 2012. This is kind of one of those reasons why I think there are things about, you know, some of these date markers and things. In 2012, I started becoming aware of and thinking about the local landscape here where I live. It's a suburb of Leeds called Headingley in Yorkshire. It's quite well known for a famous international cricket ground we have here. But we're also just about a mile from the medieval Kirkstall Abbey, which was a Cistercian abbey, which was immensely powerful here for 300 years or so in the Middle Ages. And I just started getting interested in the historical landscape, what I call the mythic landscape. And then a local planning inquiry, which has not yet been resolved. But it would have, it threatens basically to cut down many hundreds of mature trees, many of which would be have been planted in the Victorian time. And then this triggered off something. It's funny how these kind of series of, it's like a series of dominoes, because Professor J.R.R. Tolkien happened to be a professor of English here at Leeds University for a short period after the First World War, before he got his position at Oxford, which was obviously what he wanted. But he made quite a mark while he was here. And I started looking at trees and thinking, would Tolkien have known that tree? And it was like a kind of doorway into history. And I started finding a lot of locations around here which bear strong resemblance to places in the Lord of the Rings. And there was an old Shire oak that was still here when he was here, and it fell down some year after he left. It was 1,000 years old, and it was Anglo-Saxon, and it had an Anglo-Saxon history apparently. And there are several things about this which kind of creep into the Lord of the Rings, because I think this is where he got his idea of Treebeard the Ent from, because in the book he describes it, Treebeard, as a 14-foot tall stump. Well, this Shire oak that he saw at the end of his street when he first came here was a 14-foot stump of oak, and he will have passed this every day on his way to the university. This is all kind of literary ephemera in some ways, but at the same time, it brought me into a deeper understanding of the mythic and historical roots of our culture and our peoples. In fact, just the other day, I had a little meeting with Odinists within a few feet of that location, and it was a very interesting experience to feel that we were in some way connecting with that ancient meeting place and the ancient meeting that these people will have had, you know, 1,000 years ago, when they were, you know, having their Olvingi or their Wapentake on that very spot. It's very interesting to try and, it's kind of like some kind of mystical exercise to, you know, if you have a place where things have happened before and people have been of interest, then you can, it, you know, it's kind of getting in touch with that morphic field, that resonance, that history.
Yeah, I wonder if there is this interplay between morphic fields and politics, if there's some kind of imprinting that happens and which way that goes. Have you thought about that?
Well, yes, I think that you have the linguistic level. We know a lot about neurolinguistic programming now, the way that language, words can be tweaked, said in certain ways, structured, developed, and presented in such a way as to shape the way that you think about things. And I think this is what cultural Marxism is about, isn't it? It's about grabbing your attention, about grabbing your thought and directing you in a particular way. Now, one of the things I think that this particularly applies to is that when they see some evolutionary development coming along, such as agency and empowerment, it has to be hijacked so that a genuine human evolutionary drive can be replaced with nothing but a linguistic meme. So I think it's designed to redirect us away from our own sense of empowerment. I mean, you get this in the alternative research movement. You know, you will find people attacking other people, wasting energy, getting lost in distractions, all these things, rather than just, you know, simply just getting on with the creative and productive. I don't know if you've read any of the Dune books, Lana.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah. I'm an immense fan of the Dune series.
And yeah, me too.
I think they're fantastic. And I think some of the ideas that Frank Herbert put in there are absolutely classic. And for instance, the character of Duncan Idaho, in the first book, he's killed. Then his body is reclaimed. The Tylaxu reanimate his body. There's all this stuff about this in Dune, readers will know. And then, but as we know, the reanimated Gola, as they're called, do not have any memory of their past lives. They're just a kind of living automata that does what it's told. They have all the bodily memories, so Duncan Idaho is still an excellent bodyguard, but he doesn't remember anything. However, when he is put in a position where he has been programmed by his new masters to assassinate the Emperor Pol Mudib, this creates such a cognitive conflict in his mind that it wakes up those real memories. And I think that we're in a kind of situation like that at the moment. In the Vedic texts, they talk about the diamond body, which is, if one thinks about the metaphor of a diamond is carbon that's been compressed under heat to the point where it fuses into a perfectly ordered lattice, and you can't, it's virtually indestructible. And this is the idea of the truly awakened being, is that they have, I think there's all this, meditating under a bow tree until you achieve enlightenment. I just don't see where that gets you, because it's just doing nothing, isn't it? You know, to me, the real enlightenment is facing a really difficult conflict and realizing that you have to do something about it and taking responsibility and agency for it.
And not being endlessly compassionate until you're just destroyed and sacrificed altogether.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, one of my favorite stories from the Bhagavad Gita is, well, basically it's the whole essence of the Bhagavad Gita. When Arjuna is, the night before the Battle of Kurukshetra, Arjuna is sitting beside the campfire with Krishna, and he says to Krishna, look, my relatives, I think it's the Kaurava, are going to all come and kill me and my family in the morning. Do I have to fight them? And, well, I'm kind of paraphrasing Krishna here a bit, but basically Krishna says, well, you could always let them kill you. You know, whereas Arjuna kind of realizes that all this stuff that Krishna has been telling you about, you have to maintain the body and, you know, you have to constantly fight against decay, which is the same as the Egyptian, battle between Osiris and Set. You know, it's a never-ending battle against never-ending decay, and it's a never-ending resurrection. This is the cycle of life, death and rebirth that is found in, well, you know, it permeates most religions, but what we really need to do is not see it as some remote God figure who's doing this, but actually that is taking place within us, that we need to face this, face these conflicts and not capitulate, because that is, it's back to the amoeba and the cell walls, really.
What did you think of the crop circle? I don't know if you know about it, in the shape of a kolavrat or the spinning wheel. It's kind of a swastika-like ancient European symbol. Did you see that?
I did see that. I didn't know what to make of it. I mean,
it's almost like an imprinting of our European consciousness right now, because this is such a big topic. And I almost felt like the earth was saying, I'm with you, I support
well,
you.
Well, I wondered about that.
I've been in them. Really? Yeah, I don't think it's two guys with a board. No. I don't think it's aliens. Yeah. I think it's some kind of phenomena that's happening on earth. And, and it's probably tied into our collective consciousness.
I think you're right. And this one that you've just suggested kind of make cause us to have to revise. The original idea was that this is aliens trying to send us messages.
And then it was government, right?
Yeah, I can entertain that. It's as likely to be something that's being produced by our own collective mind. Touching on my art therapy background, it wouldn't surprise me in the least if this was some kind of 100th monkey externalization of some kind of forming, coalescing archetype.
Which is funny because the crop circle community was very quiet about interpreting this one.
Well, it is, yes. And, I think we have to look at these things. And I mean, like, this whole area is something that's very, very difficult for the New Age, you know, community and movement to get to grips with. But I think that it is perfectly summed up by those, you know, what Stephen Rubach said, you know, 8 years ago about Piscean rescuing versus Aquarian taking responsibility. Yes, I've got a little story actually from in the very first art therapy workshop I ever did, or it was a week-long course, but in the final workshop we did a group painting. We all had different sections on this large sheet of paper, and then there were various different adventures from one person's territory into another. So you can see it's like a kind of people are kind of putting out, you know, claiming territory, defining boundaries, all that kind of stuff, which is easily understandable in terms of work like this, art therapy groups. And then somebody started taking the tubes of coloured paint and squeezing them all into the centre and then turning it into a spiral. So for a while, it looked really beautiful. But I think you can probably see where it went. Because if you kept, and I remember, I don't know if it was me or somebody said, oh, don't keep stirring it because it'll all turn into mud.
Yeah, one big blob of no color.
That's right. So this beautiful spiral of all these different colors got turned into just one brown, muddy color. Mm. And, well, the very, very controversial thing that I should probably say or not say about it was that the person who did that was the only non-European person in the group. And I'll tell you what, now that was 35 years ago, and I hadn't thought about it until last year when this subject started coming up a lot.
Interesting, huh? You take all these people, you smoosh them together, you tell them to have children together and bring their culture together, and then it becomes a whole lot of just nothing, basically. Mm. A glob of something, kind of, you know.
I'm definitely still with some kind of concept of New Age, but I think it's something that has to be properly re-envisioned, because I think there are indeed historical changes and that are happening on the world. You know, obviously the technology that's come along in the last 50 years or so, the new ideas. I mean, I'm very encouraged by, there was a fundamental quantum particle called an amplituhedron has just been discovered. And I'm kind of thinking, well, maybe this is kind of can be analogous to finding some kind of hitting bottom, so we can get back, so we can find that irreducible center, that irreducible core that I dare say the deconstructionists will say doesn't exist. I think we have to work with our own core sense of identity and not let them be deconstructed endlessly. I mean, it's a bit like that example in Bertrand Russell's Problems of Philosophy. Right at the beginning, he says, we have here a brown table, but of course it's not really a brown table. It's really trillions of whirling electrons and stuff. But of course, I think that it's really misleading to say that, because it is both the brown table and the whirling electrons. And we shouldn't get into this complete reductionist thing where we get away from the level of consciousness and conceptualization and feeling we have, because otherwise we are in danger of this Marxist, cultural Marxist deconstruction. You're nothing but this, you're nothing but that, blah, 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 without remembering that we are a great deal more than that.
That's right.
And we are our history, our ancestors. You know, we are embedded in that. And I just really am concerned about, you know, the future, where if we carry on with this, just thinking everything can be deconstructed or everything can be dealt with on linguistic levels, then it is not survival adaptive. I mean, this is one of my big things. We have to look at things in terms of evolutionary, psychological, survival adaptation with these things. And all this cultural Marxist memes, deconstruction. What is the survival adaptive value of knowing that a table is made of millions of electrons? Not nearly as much, at least immediately, as it is of knowing it's a useful thing to put things on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We just get lost. That's the whole point of this. You just kind of lose you and take you away from reality. I think there is the potential, you know, in parts of the New Age movement to recognize this, because it has arisen out of genuine historical events and genuine historical trends. It's just that certain schools of thought have tried to always misdirect it away from where we should really be going with it.
I wanted to ask you one more thing as we begin to wind down here. I know you get into in your book, and I think it's something we all unconsciously take part in, but it's about the archetypal, the rite of passage journey. And then, of course, in Europeans, we always have our hero's journey, which is so important. Our ancestors had this. Mm-hmm. They understood the importance of having this kind of rite of passage.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's lacking today, and why is it important to have that?
Oh, I think it definitely is lacking today. I mean, when I was a child, we used to be able to go out hunting for tadpoles in ditches and things like this. And children went through kind of micro rites of passage all the time because they were allowed to explore and develop. And then, of course, there would be the major rites of passage into adulthood. 13 or 14-year-old would be, you know, left out in the wild to survive or whatever overnight. I think it's an absolute essential, really. And what we have in the modern world is they're so protected, there is no chance of people ever really facing these challenges. Because this is what it's about. Basically, you know, life is a series of challenges. And if you meet those challenges, then you will grow and you will ascend and you will move on and develop. If you're protected from ever experiencing danger or conflict or challenges, then you will remain a kind of fearful child who's constantly wanting to be protected and rescued by the parent. And so you're back into that Piscean savior victim kind of mentality. We have to have some kind of managed rites of passage, you know, as humans developed, you know, whenever it was, 100,000 years or whatever, one of the first things I imagine would have been to learn how to train the younger members of the clan in the kind of experiences which would enable them to grow and become future, you know, leaders of the tribe.
I agree. I definitely agree. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I was hoping you can share your websites and let everyone know about your book and anything else you wanted to share.
My book can be found on lulu.com. Lulu.com, I think it's probably / Waking the Monkey, or you can search for me on lulu.com, either Waking the Monkey or Claire Ray Randall, RAE. I have several blogs. I try to keep them separate because they have different kind of subject matters. There's the Waking the Monkey blog, and the website of that is just wakingthemonkey.blogspot.co.uk. I also have a blog I've started recently called PC Newspeak Deconstruction, and that's pcnewspeak.blogspot.co.uk, and I talk in that about politically correct newspeak and how there's quite a long post there about gender studies, which I know is an interesting subject.
Yeah, people have no idea. You're very diverse and you can talk. And we want to definitely have you back to discuss gender studies and transsexuals and intersex. We'll definitely have to go there next time.
Thank you very much, Lana. So there's a long post on that one. And then there's also my other blog that I haven't put in much recently, but this was my main blog, cosmicclaire.blogspot.co.uk. Yes, and if anybody would like to get in touch with me, I have Facebook pages My author page is Cosmic Claire. I am Claire Ray Randall, and I have a page which is for the book Waking the Monkey.
Very good. Thank you so much, Claire.
Thanks a lot, Lana. It's been a great pleasure.
I'd encourage listeners to go into the Red Ice Radio archives and listen to Mark Passio's two shows on New Age Pacification versus Self-Preservation and the New Age Deception, because these exact same principles apply to leftist liberal thought today. They've now synced up and it's mainstream. I hear liberal atheists talking like New Age pacifists. It's weak and pathetic. And all this so-called egalitarianism, no borders, one people, one race hoopla is straight out of the hippy-dippy San Francisco drugged-up orgy anti-Western New Age scene. People used to make fun of it, but now we hear these exact same concepts in mainstream politics. But of course, one love only applies in the globalist anti-white sense. If white folks were talking about unification, one love, one race, uh-oh, you see what's happening here? I do think the concepts of the 100th monkey, morphic field, and a collective consciousness are true, but they've been grossly contorted and misapplied to all of humanity through an egalitarian, rose-colored lens. It's clear that each racial family has its own morphic field and its own unified consciousness. Clearly, because look at the evolution and progression of each race through the ages. Whites up north came into the same ideas with other whites way down south. Blacks in America act like blacks in Africa. Each race possesses its own unified consciousness that is shared through thousands, millions of years of evolution. Each people is bound by a powerful bond, clearly. Look at how each people prefers to be with their own. It's the natural order of humanity. I've said this before, but to me, race is metaphysical. The formation of different biological expressions is miraculous. And each race possesses a racial soul that is unique to our genetics, a soul that has been created over millions of years. In that regard, we transcend time and are mystical. Please Google Lana Lochteff, The Metaphysical Dimension of Racial Awareness, to hear a deeper analysis on this. In closing, to the Glastonbury listeners who pay homage to the sacred sites of Europe, who will preserve and guard these sites if whites are no longer around? Who will care? Because incoming people who have no connection to these sites don't give a damn. Look at Greece. Famous ancient sites are being vandalized. If the invasion keeps up, you can bet they'll be removed altogether, as though Greece, an important landmark of European values, never was at all. Thank you all for listening. Find me and Radio 314 on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and TuneIn. And of course, help us grow by signing up for a Red Ice membership to access all our material. Video is where we're going next. More video. Stay tuned for Claire Randall Part 2 with a juicy show on gender studies, transsexuals, cultural Marxism, and more. Also coming up is Lauren Southern and Syrian Girl. Have a good night, everyone. We'll talk soon. Passed along.